Welcome to the Love Irish Food Green Ireland podcast series, episode 7, where on this episode we are asking our guests to bring a crystal ball each with them, as we want to know what they know about the future of the food industry in Ireland and, I suppose, beyond. I am your host, Conal O'Moran. Love Irish Food is dedicated to sustainable, local Irish food and drinks brands, of course, that support the many, many, many thousands of local jobs and communities that depend on our Irish food industry. Visit loveirishfood.ie for a full list of your local brands. In this series, we're looking at topics affecting the Irish food industry, ranging from the shop local movement, funding, selling online, digital marketing, and so much more. And we have exceptional food and drink talent lined up to give you their tips, insights, and knowledge, and all in a 30 minutes or so snack size. Joining me today are John O'Connor, a man who promotes that Irish delicacy, the crisp sandwich, because he's MD of Tato Snacks, which is, in my estimation, about as much part of our heritage is as the GAA. John was appointed MD of the iconic brand in 2020, having already had over 40 years of service in the FMCG sector. He had leadership positions at C&C, Glanbia and Cadbury. Also in studio is Kevin Donnelly, MD of Britvic Ireland. He's been with Britvic since 2008 and over 30 years experience in sales, marketing and general management in FMCG companies, having worked with Unilever and Dairy Gold. Gentlemen, you are both very welcome. Kevin, you're a mere child compared to John.
Only visually.
The future. You're going to talk to me about the future. I have previously asked on these podcast about who knows the lotto numbers, but we'll leave that aside. The future of Irish food. Let me start, John, with Tato, because Tato has been with us for generations and hopefully will be with us for generations. But I know enough about Tato that you never stop trying to reinvent not the crisp, but other innovations, other brands, other categories, trying to move all the time. What's the future?
Wow. That's an interesting question. I think in the context of, if you talk about Tato, it's, as you say, we've always tried to reinvent ourselves and be relevant to the new generations coming through. And we've been everything from crisps to snacks to peanuts to chocolate, even chocolate bars. So from my perspective, where we see in terms of moving forward is always looking to innovate into new categories. You know, better for you has become something that's critically important now to consumers. And within the category we are, it's not the one that springs to mind, we're a treat category, but we've got to work hard to, you know, innovate, so to speak, and be relevant to the new shoppers out there, so to speak. So better for you is a key focus for us in our future direction.
And you say to remain relevant. So that means that in a way, just with the passing of time, that you've become irrelevant. How do you measure that? What are you doing to find out where you should next go? What new brand, what new flavor, new shape, new whatever should you be making?
Listening to consumers. It's all about listening.
How do you
to
do
consumers.
That?
From various research. I mean, we will, you know, we are consumers ourselves, so we engage in that way. We've got 350 colleagues at our production facility in Ashbourne, so they'll tell us even in terms of their feedback. But we'll constantly look in terms of right across the globe, what are the evolving trends in terms of flavors, in terms of concepts. That's where we draw our knowledge from.
Now, be honest, and this is serious. You said that you listened to your 350 colleagues at Ashbourne. But they'll be listening to this podcast. Do you actually go around? Is there a mechanism that you use? And I'll tell you why I'm asking this question, because I think it's a lovely idea that whether you've got five people or 350 people, that you actually do sit down and ask their opinions. Their opinions are as valuable as any other.
They will certainly give us their opinion. Everything we do in terms of concepts, be it flavor or be it product or, you know, different formats or that, they will see it very early on. So, you know, our technical people are the ones who engage in the first instance in that, along with our marketing teams. But then on the factory floor, you're running line trials all the time to see whether this flavor works, whether this concept works. So you don't hide it from those colleagues. They see it all day long and they will give their feedback very openly in the context of that.
I have to ask this question because I was watching a program about food production the other day and it was about secret development. Do you ever do secret developments and hide a new product in case the opposition see it?
One of the things that we are is because we're local, we're very fleet of foot. So from concept to execution is quite quick. So it's not like we would work on things for years and years and years with that fear that it will get out to the competition. So we move quite quickly. Secret development, I'm not so sure that we would push it as hard as that. Probably the greatest secret is the potato, cheese and onion flavour. And that's the one that's locked in the vault, as they say, a bit like the Coca-Cola recipe.
Kevin, I think he's denying too much. I'd say they've got something a brewing, as they might say. Talk to me about Britvic and the Britvic brands for those who may not know the extent of them.
Yeah, we tend to live through our individual brands rather than our corporate brands. We've got local brands like Ballygown, Club. We've got Maiwadi, nearly 100 years old. We've got international brands like Robinson's and Fruit Shoot. And we also bottle then exclusively for our partners, PepsiCo, and that would bring us 7-Up and Pepsi, and most recently, Rockstar Energy.
And what could be more Irish than a Club Orange and a bag of potato?
The perfect combination.
Absolutely.
Indeed.
Product development at Britvic, does that come indigenous here or is it international? Or where are you thinking up new thoughts about new products or new lines or new drinks or different ways of serving your drinks? Because I do know that on your Ballygown that you have gone sustainable, that you're gone all green.
We have. I mean, the product development on all of our brands, except for the PepsiCo brands, which are global brands, all of that product development work is done locally. And you're right, it's not just liquid, although we make good liquids, it's also packaging, and increasingly so given the importance of sustainability. But all of that is done locally with a lot of trial and error, to John's point earlier. Because I think gone are the days when you put a load of investment up front and test things to the nth degree. I think speed to market is key, and this concept of failing forward. So not everything we do works, but
roughly,
we're agile.
Roughly speaking, how many things do you try and that actually make it through? 1 in 10, 1 in 100?
Well, we have a funnel, not a gun. So you'll have more ideas at the far end of the funnel than you will near in. We tend to generate a lot of ideas, and I agree with John, sometimes the staff, because there's no hierarchy with ideas, and we actively encourage that. But we tend to rule out the ideas early on, because the longer you leave them in the funnel, the more cost you're accumulating. But we've a decent success rate. I mean, innovation in soft drinks takes various formats. There's what we'd call renovation, which is usually flavour innovation, which if it's done off the main brand tends to be fairly risk-free. So the likes of a Pat Frog this year, which was a Club Orange limited edition, which ran out or hopped off the shelves, I should say. We've just launched Club Dark Stuff, which is a new variant as well. But if you launch a brand new concept, then that's got a higher risk profile, will take longer to pay back. And for those ideas, you'd certainly do a lot more homework before you launched.
I know a little about the drinks business and about shelf space. Trying to get, even for a fabulously well-established company like your own, shelf space from the multiples, no matter if you produce bars of gold for them, you have to beat your way, win your way with that shelf space. What is the secret?
You have to start with category rationale. It's got to work for the category. It's got to expand the category, either by getting existing users to buy more, or indeed, more importantly, bringing new users into the category. If all you're doing with your innovation is salami slicing the existing cake, you'll be found out pretty quickly. The innovation has got to increase the size of the overall cake.
But your salami might be a better salami than the opposition's one. And all you want to do is shift the opposition off the shelf.
Well, the shelves are not elastic. But there's, like in any category, there's quite a lot of duplication. So you've got to root it out. It tends to be a one in, one out. And usually the pressure is to take one of your own out. Yeah. But if the category rationale is strong enough, you can construct an argument where actually it's not just one in, one out on your own portfolio. And you know what? I mean, buyers, by and large, are rational creatures when it comes to innovation. And they see something we don't do. They see the consumer trends right across the shopping basket. So it's almost that combination of the specialist knowledge of the individual category from the supplier meets the more general knowledge of the shopper with the buyer. And somewhere in there comes the right solution for the category.
This is just me, which is a real lead into a difficult question. Were either of you ever absolutely way out surprised by something that was introduced? You said to yourself, oh, that'll never work. And then it was a runaway success. Either of you?
I don't think I would have ever been as strong as saying that will never work. I might have had...
That's the kind of thing I say. Yeah, with absolute certitude, and I'm wrong.
I might have had a view that it would have limited appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Because never would have launched it if that wasn't the case. But yeah, been caught out in the context of, you know, a runaway success. We only had one recently where we introduced a retro product, Banshee Bones, and we thought, yeah, you know, we'll get a stint on it. It'll be a limited edition for a period of time. We'll connect with nostalgia and then we'll move on.
I'm going to impress you. I saw those during Halloween, didn't I?
Well, there you go. We launched it last year for a Halloween thing. It would be an in and out event, so to speak.
We've had to bring it back fully.
It's on the shelves and we can't make enough of it.
And I bet you kids just love them.
They love them.
Yeah.
Absolutely love them.
Well, I just point out Ballygowan. You can remember when Jeff Reed presented it on The Late Late Show.
I'll go back further. I was in RTE when it was launched and I had Jeff Reed. I was business correspondent. I interviewed Jeff Reed back then.
Well, you must have started in RTE very young.
But this is a love-in at this stage.
Well, it wasn't a love-in for Jeff.
No, because it wasn't. Obviously, I said, this is never going to work.
I mean, it was ridiculed.
40 years later, it's still working.
I mean, you can have a neutral response to a new concept, but that was ridiculed.
Yeah.
And then the subsequent...
Irish people paying for water.
Well, never. The subsequent events, though, because I think the one thing that people don't mention is that slice of luck you need if something is to go big. And of course, what happened with Jeff was... There was that scare with Perrier at the time, the benzene scare. Because Perrier had 99% of the market.
Yeah.
It was okay, you know, buying French water, but Irish water at the time was seen to be a bit of a joke. So,
and just for those who don't remember, because there will be younger listeners remember, benzene was allegedly found in Perrier water, and benzene is not a good idea to be drinking.
No, it's not. Mm. And therefore, Jeff, in fairness, because you need luck, but you need the agility then to actually... capitalise on it. He was the only show in town, and Ballygowan then became market leader. Mm. That was a few years after The Late Late Show and hasn't lost that position since.
That takes hard work. So what is the hard work that you guys put into it? And I'm asking the question on behalf of those many people who are starting out with their own little drinks, and I've met them and I love them, and they need to know from a market leader like yourselves what they should or could be doing.
Well, I think you've got to believe in the opportunity because there'll be plenty of internal obstacles and indeed external challenge to any new idea. And some new ideas take a while to bear fruit, particularly if they're more radical with the consumer. And I can show you, you know, a chart on Fruit Shoot, for example, which didn't do much for the first few years and then suddenly took off because of a combination of circumstances. So my big advice is believe in the opportunity, stick with it, of course, listen, but don't lose sight of what might be a bit of a longer term payback. Unfortunately, we're all maybe looking for an instant win with innovation. They're very rare. So stick with it and believe in the opportunity would be my advice.
And sticking with it is what costs money. And even then, it cannot necessarily take off. So that's a kind of a difficult one.
The other thing I'd say is that I think the most important thing in any brand, especially a new brand, and I'm going to get all boring here.
Oh no, this is what we want to hear.
Is a high gross margin. Because if you don't have it, you don't have room underneath to invest. You don't have room over time as the market matures, maybe to discount a little bit further down as you get threatened by competition. I'm horrified sometimes when I talk to younger marketeers coming through that they never mention gross margin.
Yeah.
And to me, an opportunity is only worth going after and sticking with if it delivers at that level in the P&L.
And that is very interesting. Is it that your marketeers are not being taught that? Or is it, why would it not be front of mind?
Well, it's not sexy, you see, because marketing at times tends to go
margin
towards...
Margin is very sexy. Well, hey, that is the sex of business, is it not?
But not necessarily in terms of where their traditional... education comes from, exactly. Is creative.
Yeah.
So it's the idea about what can we create. The profitability, is that somebody else's consideration? And I think just to what Kevin was saying there about in terms of launching a product and having that perseverance, I mean, if you're launching a product, you have to create what is the reason to purchase. If you're a Me Too coming to the marketplace, then you're going to struggle. So, you know, what is that reason to purchase and perseverance on the base of that? And it doesn't always have to be expensive to launch a brand. You can be very creative. If you think of some of the things that, you know, the Tato brand has done over the years, and you know, they use the terminology guerrilla marketing, but it was literally, you know, on reasonably tight budgets, creating an incredible impression within the marketplace. So, you know, I think there are creative ways to do it. It doesn't always have to cost significant cash. But I think Kevin is right. If you don't start off with the basic fundamentals of getting the financials right and having justification that you are going to take that money and give the conviction to your customer, to the retailer, so to speak, to stock the product, that you're going to invest in this brand, then you're on, you know, a road to nowhere, so to speak. So I think it is critical in terms of, you know, do your homework and don't even to the extent, have the conviction in your own right when someone turns around and says, it's too expensive or I want greater margins. You've got to be firm in your view in the context of that. And you may only get one customer, but that's all you need to start a revolution. So I think there's some of the insights that I would have of you on it as well.
And ironically, the more radical the innovation, the less useful consumer research is.
I mean, that's a fair point.
I mean, the
it?
Henry yeah, Ford yeah. example, that if he asked his consumers what they wanted, they would have said, I wanted a faster horse. Yeah. And I think that requires great courage of conviction, because a radical thought, you can't depend on consumer research and you're about to invest a lot of money up front. That's where, to John's
and
point.
You're winning hard. You're really trying to win a heart and mind then in terms of something that's untested.
But if it's untested, that's the time to get your pricing right.
Yeah.
That's the time to have your margin high, because chances are, apart from economies of scale, as you go forward and mature, there's going to be a lot more pressure on you. So that's the time to get that pricing margin decision right.
And I think what's really interesting is there's a lot of talk about premiumization of the categories. And that's where you can get that margin, where you come in with something that really has a reason to be declared as premium. And then you can build a structure into your pricing.
But is that not an attitude? So therefore, Mary or John are making something and they believe it should be premium. So that's where they're going to try to sell it. They think it's God's gift.
But I think if we were to look at the category, the crisps category, you had standard crisps, flat crisps off what you call the mainline production line. And then along came hand-cooked through a kettle. Still, by and large, you know, a basic process of, you know, taking a potato and frying it in oil. But then getting a reason to say to consumers, this is different, taste the product. Now, you have to be true to what you're saying at the same time. You can't just say this is premium and it not. You've got to be able to give a reason to purchase that it is premium. But, you know, if you look at kind of in those segmentation of categories where you have mainstream, you have value for money, and you have premium, you can create these categories.
You are listening to the Love Irish Food podcast. For more information, visit www.loveirishfood.ie.
Both of you have terrific Irish brands, be they Tato and Ballygowan, Club. Both of you, did you ever think of, in terms of innovation, of trying to spread it out, to use the Tato brand, for example, for something completely different?
Well, as I said, we did venture into the chocolate market at one point in time, and I think we actually got a market share in the chocolate confectionery category.
Remind me.
Yeah, we did it about years ago, and by so quick at this stage, it's about 5, 6, 7 years ago. And when you talk about, you know, social media and how people, you know, can be influenced by social media. And this was as simple as somebody posting up that we had a chocolate bar over in our Tato Park, just a normal chocolate bar. And when she posted it up on her social media account, people said, is it cheese and onion tasting? And everyone said, oh my God, wouldn't that be absolutely amazing? And then we, fleet of foot, contacted Butler's Chocolates, it actually was, and said, could you put cheese and onion crisps in this chocolate bar? And it literally went through the roof.
And you're still making them?
No. I decided that with staying savory snacks, confectionery, we'll leave it to somebody else within that category.
But as a matter of interest, because it's actually a brilliant idea, is why would you pull out? Is it just because, as you correctly say, that's what you're focused on?
Yeah, I think it's important to remain focused. And I think it's, you know, if you concentrate on the core and you try to build the core of your business, and there's lots of iterations within your categories that you can start to build upon. Distraction is a dangerous thing. And I think, you know, even for companies, you know, that are they're starting off on the journey, they think, you know, I launch one product and then I need to launch two or three or four different ones and iterations. That starts to drag your resource and it drags your focus. It drags your investment. So at the end of the day, from our perspective, if we concentrate on the core, we believe there's lots more opportunity to build a business and expand our business. And that's been proved over, what, 67 years Tato was 67 years, and obviously then Hunky Dory and King and all of that came along, you know. But yeah, so it's, you know, there's always opportunities to innovate within your own category.
And amongst Irish people, of course, it's a world brand.
Yeah, it's
I know people in Australia who would love to have a bag of crisps at the moment. Well, Tato crisps.
they can actually get Tato crisps in Australia at the moment. We have a great relationship with a chap called Eamon Eastwood in Australia, and he has a company called Food Ireland. I'd say some of your products are with Kevin as well. And he literally has harnessed all the great Irish brands and he sells them in Australia at this point in time.
Well, done him.
And that's fantastic for us because, you know, again, focus. Do you want to be running across the world trying to develop brands if you think that there's a more cost-effective way to do it?
Large brands, you know, I won't name them, but large, massive companies. Mm. That's what they do. They use that brand to say, this is a quality chocolate, this is a quality sandwich. I don't know, I'm making things up now. Yeah. But that they use the brand, as you could with, say, Tato, and we'll get on to Club and all in a second, but that if you really went for broke, because broke might be a different
word. That's the word that you want to avoid at the end of the day. You can go into any country in the world. It's probably an Irish bar within every city that we visit, and you'll find Tato. Mm-hmm. But that is not us directly putting it in. Okay. That's us identifying people who are on the ground within those countries and building relationships with them. And it works. You know, there's still people who can, you know, who love their Tato and can get their Tato in every corner of the world, so to speak.
So can I go into a bar in Hamburg or a bar in Sydney and get a Club Orange?
You can, mainly through the same routes that John is taking with Tato. But I agree on the point about focus. I think stretching brands was your original question. And to me, it depends on what the brand stands for. So some brands are very famous for one thing. Other brands might have an essence that could transfer. And my own experience over the years is that it is possible to stretch into adjacent areas. So for example, we've just launched My Waddy in a frozen format, actually. A machine that actually, a bit like Slush Puppy.
Okay.
And that's working extremely well. That's a stretch of effectively the same proposition into a different format. So I'm a great believer in format stretching. Mm. And we have these little mini squashes as well, which is pocket squash, because you can't really bring a big bottle around with you. So I'm a great believer in stretching core brands into relevant areas because it's efficient and you're getting a maximum return on investment in the master brand. But going too far from home geographically or going too far from home in terms of the credibility of a brand, that's when I think John is right. You're overstretching and then your stretch doesn't work and then you're diluting focus on your core. So it's a double whammy.
And our two categories have great experience in terms of stretching a brand into different formats, you know, be it a small single bag or a small single bottle or a large bottle or a multi-pack format. And then you're really connecting with different consumers and different kind of need
occasions,
states, so to speak,
as well.
And occasions. Yeah.
I mean, the one other aspect, and we don't talk about it a lot, is licensing brands. So you could envisage, you know, Club Orange range of t-shirts, for example.
Now, that is the kind of thing I was thinking of.
In the UK, we've done a great job at Robinson's. You can get Robinson's sweets and so on. So for example, that's where you're taking the essence of taste and delivering a different format, but you wouldn't manufacture it yourself.
Yeah.
You would license the brand to somebody else. And there's a small but growing market in licensing, but there's only a select number of brands that they need to have badge value in order to be in the game of licensing.
You think about this a lot, don't you?
Among other things.
I don't think you do. I think this is what you live for, isn't it?
well, we are fortunate people. I mean, our brands are bought every 7 seconds. I'm sure yours is very... So you can walk into any shop or pub or whatever and go, that's my brand. I was involved in that. Like, I'd find it difficult to get out of bed in the morning to be involved in, say, printed circuit board manufacturing. Nothing against that.
Intangibles, as they say.
You two are both talking about margin earlier on. I bet you there's a big fat margin in that.
I bet you there is. But there's something nice about being in a consumer-facing industry.
Yeah. There's a great emotional connection with it. I mean,
there is.
You know, Kev was talking about T-shirts and all that. And I mean, we have Tato Park. And, you know, if there's ever an emotional connection with people, you know, connecting product to an experience.
An incredible success.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was the vision of Raymond Coyle at the time that he owned the Tato brand and literally, you know, said, look, across the road, we've told that people
now,
have heard the story.
Tell me the truth. Did you believe that would work?
I have to say I had significant reservations about the success, but I remember him talking about the level of investment and the numbers of people that he thought would come, which was at times nearly more than the Irish population. But
and he was right.
It's been a phenomenal success. I mean, you know, pre-COVID, obviously, and there wouldn't, on average, every year would have been about 700,000 visitors a year to the park.
Fantastic.
And that just connects because we talked about the relevance of a brand and, you know, growing with you know, growing your brand with the generations that come through. And like, everybody knows Tato, but everyone knows Tato from the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and 80s. But where does your relevance come through as the generations come through? So, you know, from our perspective, you know, you only have to walk around that park and you see from children in pushchairs all the way up to grandparents coming through, and that's the real emotional connection that.
Well,
you
here
can
I'm
build.
Going to give throw out a hard question now, because for me, Tato, Club Orange, both belong in a pub. Now, you know, obviously much wider than that. If there is going to be, and I think there may be, a big shift in pub going, they're being closed down pretty quickly at the moment. Is there what's your thinking on that section of your businesses, whether it be on the drink side or on the Mr. Tato in the pub?
Yeah. I think it has a greater implication potentially for Kevin, Kevin's business, so to speak. I mean, yes, you'll always get a bag of Tato or King or any of our brands within a pub, but the scale of it is on a reasonably limited level, considering, you know, the volume that you get out of a supermarket or a convenience store, so to speak. I mean, during COVID, we saw the pain of that, where, you know, the hospitality sector and food service literally was brought to its knees and fully closed. And from our perspective, you know, and I think like a lot of food companies in Ireland, drink companies in Ireland, they weathered the storm reasonably well in the context that, you know, everyone was locked at home, they were watching Netflix, and, you know, they were munching through food or preparing food and so on and so forth. That became their entertainment. So, you know, we saw a surge within, you know, our consumption levels, different pack formats, obviously, in the supermarkets. And even the convenience stores changed their offering from single bag offerings to share bag offerings and multi-pack. So what's very interesting is that those levels of participation have continued as we've started to come through the journey of COVID, and yet the convenience sector is starting to move forward. So I think, you know, people will find their amusement in different ways, their entertainment in different ways, and I think they will remain connected with it. So whether it's, you know, home entertainment, I think, you know, they will still engage within the category. I know, Kevin, from your perspective, it probably had a bigger impact, the pub trade.
It had. I mean, we used to sell alcohol up until recently. We had a wholesale business, because so we sold the alcohol, we sold the gin as well as the tonic. But we've closed that business out because alcohol is not core for us. And to be honest, with the pub trade closed for so long, it just wasn't sustainable. But we're at an interesting point, actually, I think, because the pub trade is back, as are restaurants. The mix of product that's being sold is very different to pre-COVID, actually. So consumers are either looking for product now when they're out of home that they can't replicate at home. So there's been a big growth in cocktails since the reopening because that's special and you can't do them that well at home. Mm. Big increase in draft because you can't do that well at home. So I think there'll always be a role for eating out and drinking out. Ireland is at a different stage to some other countries. We look very closely at the London market, for example, and they're a little bit ahead of us in the timetable in terms of the reopening. So similar trends, a bit more celebratory drinking, But a young cohort coming through, not drinking alcohol at all, or reducing consumption compared to previous generations. So that's why you see the development of no and low alcohol. Quite an opportunity for soft drinks, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And real evidence that when people are out, drinking less, but spending a bit more. And then you've got this enormous business that's emerged now of drinking at home. So I think the market will still grow, but it won't be defined along the traditional lines of on and off trade. It'll be blurring. So as a brand owner now, not as an alcohol wholesaler anymore, as a soft drinks brand owner, we're focused on developing more premium offerings. And then to John's point earlier, offerings in formats that are targeted at the different channels. But the market will be bigger, I think, than pre-COVID, but maybe more fragmented across many different occasions in different locations. And that puts a little bit of pressure on the suppliers in terms of offering the same brand, but in different formats through different channel strategies. So that's a big puzzle for all of us to actually try to solve.
That is very intriguing. What are you thinking? What are you saying to me, really? Are you going to make bigger bottles, smaller bottles, squarer bottles?
Well, all of that. Yeah. All of that. We've just gone into a non-returnable format for the on-trade because we had a returnable format and lots of pubs said, look, it's just too much hassle now to be returning the bottles.
But is that sustainable now?
Well, you see, it is on a total life cycle basis because we were consuming an awful lot of energy and water rewashing bottles and collecting bottles. And, you know, a one way on this occasion is a bit more efficient from a logistics point of view. I think we're going to see a growth in solutions that have no packaging at all. So we have an offering in development, which we call London Essence Company Fresh Serve, which is effectively a range of tonics, flavoured tonics, that are actually produced on dispense in the pub. So you avoid all of the glass packaging. And in fact, it's a fresher product.
And how's that transported?
It's in a bag and box.
Okay.
But the actual flavour is added at the point of production on the bar. So if you have your elderflower tonic, for example, it hasn't been put in the liquid in a factory, put in a pack and then gone through the supply chain. It's actually done there and then. So you're saving all of that packaging and you're getting a fresher product. So I think we're going to see, because the ultimate expression, I think, of sustainable packaging is potentially no packaging at all. And that of itself opens up a whole world of opportunity. So with disruption, and you're right to call out disruption in the pub trade and restaurant trade, comes opportunity for those who are agile enough to take it.
The poor barman who, or bar person, should I say, they used to be just asked for a pint of Guinness, and now they're going to be said, can I have a gin and tonic with elderflower tonic and two lime leaves and something else?
And worse, while you're at it, can I have my macchiato latte as well? But this is an issue, actually, because there's a shortage of labour in a lot of the channels, particularly in the hospitality sector, and barman has to become... Bar person has to become barista, you know, cocktail maker, mixologist, and a person who can pull a good pint as well. So there's certainly an opportunity for labour-saving solutions for anybody who's selling into the hospitality sector. I think having labour-saver solutions would be a real winning concept.
Japanese will bring you the robot. I don't think we're ready for that yet. What about the future? Because that's what we're really meant to be talking about. This is really interesting, but I have to ask about the future. John, where will Mr. Tato be and his many friends, Mr. Hunky Dory and all the rest of them, in, say, 5 years' time?
I hope, as long as I'm involved in the business, that he will be continually relevant within the marketplace to new consumers.
What kind of plans have you got?
Yeah, we do have to look in terms of, you know, what does that look like in those 5 years? But I think, you know, I'm encouraged by the opportunities. I think we need to look at our products. As we mentioned earlier there, we're in the treat category. So we're not selling health and wellness, but at least people understand that when they engage within our categories, that they are treat categories. But that's not a reason for us not to try and make our products better, healthier, so to speak. So we're looking at reformulations on our products all the time. you know, in terms
not
of taking...
Not on Tato. Please not on Tato.
Never change Tato. Conal, you won't notice the difference because we wouldn't dream of allowing, you know, a
That's
packet...
That's what they said when they changed the formulation of various chocolates and things. Was never the same.
Well, we talked about all the colleagues back in Ashbourne at the factory, and we're constantly looking at... you know, the flavors are flavors that we have at the moment and trying to improve them to be, you know, 100% natural flavors to hit the FSA salt targets, to hit what you call no use of flavor enhancers or anything like that. So we've made a commitment within our business by 2023. So that's well within the 5-year plan that we will be 100% clean in all of our products in that context. So, you know, there's some of the elements that we look at. And then you're looking at what's the next trends that are coming through. So, you know, lentil, we're just about to launch lentil this month into the marketplace. Mr. Tato goes into lentil. So it's constantly looking at, you know, what are we doing in terms of our innovation program to make sure that we are connecting. So, yeah, it is a lot about innovation, reformulation, and getting your message out as well. And then sustainability is a much broader sense as well, that I think if any manufacturers in the marketplace are not genuine, and credible with consumers, they will fall back, they will lose ground. So that's a big, big focus for us as well about the whole sustainability issue within the business, across all the spectrum.
You know, across the road from the factory in Ashbourne, there are bison.
There are.
Now tell the truth.
Hmm.
Is that what goes into Hunky Dory?
No, it's not. I can confirm that. I don't want the animal health.
I remember that
lobby,
founder Ray Coyle always wanted to give the impression that it was little beasties across the road. But then when you go to the back of the factory, I think it's Kerry Group, I think, who make the actual flavor.
We'll ask them, we'll say to them, you know, that's what a buffalo tastes like when you cook it. But yeah, get us a flavor that works towards that, so to speak. So I can confirm that no animals used in the product.
Final question to you, Kevin. Britvic, 5 years' time, where will it be?
Healthy people, healthy planet. So further sugar reduction, alternatives to sugar, more natural sweeteners, lower carbon footprint. Less packaging weight per serve, more recycled packaging content, and manufactured still in Ireland. The Irish value chain is vital to us. It gives us agility, it gives us local focus, and we've got very exciting plans to be bigger, more sustainable and healthier by 2025.
You're going to be busy. And that is Kevin Donnelly, MD of Britvic Ireland. And just before that, I was talking to John O'Connor, MD of Tato Snacks, both fantastic Irish brands, because this is the Love Irish Food Green Ireland podcast series, episode 7. Do listen back to the other 6 podcasts. They're well worth listening to. And I think today's podcast was really interesting, particularly if you're on the marketing side of the industry, because I'm learning as well. Not that I'm in the industry, but so long as Mr. Tato isn't reformulated, everybody's happy. Thank you for joining us.
The Love Irish Food Podcast. For more information, visit www.loveirishfood.ie.